Hello and welcome to Computer Lab Hijinks, a show about games, old software, and web ephemera. In a series I'm now dubbing Nathan's 27-year playthrough of every N64 game, we're doing just that. Reviews and video essays on all 296 N64 games released in North America, with a few digressions for some of the more interesting Japan exclusives like Evangelion and Animal Forest. But today we're looking at Super Mario 64, a game that has been discussed to death, reviewed to death, and made playable on almost every Nintendo console since, with the exception of the GameCube, although the instruction manual teases us with this weird memory card graphic of a GameCube port. Strange. As well, Mario 64 is a game increasingly known for its derivative works. Viva la Vida in the Mario sound font. Explanations of arcane speedrun challenges that dip into theories on parallel universes. And mods that incorporate fan remakes of high-poly promotional models. There's a lot we talk about when we talk about Mario 64, and rightfully so. This was the blueprint for 3D worlds as game developers moved into the new millennium. In this video, I'm going to present some highly subjective personal musings on the game. Not quite a review, but also not a review. And just to give my footage the slightest amount of visual distinction, mostly for my own amusement, I used a mod by this Kingdom Hearts fan on YouTube that turns Mario into Sora from Kingdom Hearts. Cause why not? So without further ado, let's dive right in. I'd be remiss if I didn't open this video by talking about the controls, which, with the notable exception of moving the camera, hold up remarkably well. There's something about the way you build speed, the jumping mechanics, the side flips, the long jumps that are absolutely perfect. The rules of the next decade of platformers are codified in this one game, right down to crucial details like the shadow texture that helps with landing precise jumps. All the best levels in the world could have felt like flat images on a screen with the kind of stiff controls we saw in other platformers around this time. Croc, Tomb Raider, though not technically a platformer, and heck, even Bubsy 3D. It took a few years before other companies would adapt the Mario 64 model into their own games. But there's a feeling that these are worlds built for play and interaction, and not just artistic marvel. I don't remember the first time I played Mario 64. My secondhand N64 came with a copy of GoldenEye, so that's probably the game I played first. And I never had the money for new release games until I was well into college. So I don't remember the hype for this game, nor did I play it with any sort of reverence for it being a genre-defining title. But I remember the different worlds and how it felt to slowly discover them, and the distinct sense that this was a game that went on forever. There are, of course, exactly 15 worlds and 3 boss levels, which are all comparatively small by today's standards. But because this game took place in a massive hub environment, it gave the effect of constantly discovering new levels. Hazy Maze Cave, in particular, was a fairly late discovery in my playthrough, and that's just as well because its layout is exactly as confusing as the name suggests. And I'm moderately ashamed to admit that it was only when capturing footage for this video that I discovered you can direct the swimming beast by facing the direction you want him to go. So I'm quite literally still discovering new things in a game I've been playing for over 2 decades. In a sense, this game might actually go on forever. It's also a much more story-rich world than the game often gets credit for. In terms of sheer plot, yes, the setup is nearly identical to earlier games, and we don't exactly learn big emotional truths about the human condition from Bowser or Peach. But storytelling covers more than just plot information, and at the risk of extrapolating too much meaning from a game like this, there's an interesting story being told. Like Cyan's Mist before it, Mario 64 offers an in-universe explanation for all these discrete virtual worlds hidden behind paintings in the castle. Are these real, faraway places that we're linking to from the paintings, or do they only exist within the paintings? I don't know if we ever find out, but I enjoy the mystery. In terms of characters, the Bob-ombs seem to have taken their individual sides in this Bowser versus everybody else ongoing war, which gives them an odd kind of agency that they didn't previously have, particularly since a handful of them have actual dialogue. It's not the first Mario game to use speech bubbles, but there's more than ever before, and it allows for a deceptively rich level of world building in what is otherwise a straightforward game about running, jumping, and punching. And this leads to some of the highest praise I can give any fictional world. In a very real way, the levels feel like they existed before the events of the game. Jolly Roger Bay contains a sunken ship that has since become the property of this scary eel thing. Someone was here, something bad happened, and now you're piecing it all together. Similarly, Big Boo's Haunt is a haunted house in the well-established formula of Mario World's ghost houses, but adapted into a free-roam level, with slightly less non-linear trickery. It's among the game's more physically confined spaces, and somehow, you just know something horrible went down here. For starters, you need to go into a graveyard and punch a ghost just to get in, and once you're there, it's a gothic mansion with a subterranean merry-go-round and an angry piano that bites you. You even get a warning dialogue right at the start of the level, letting you know that this isn't a cheery, colorful sandbox like the rest of the world. This place actively doesn't want you there. Perhaps, in a Shirley Jackson kind of twist, the house belongs to the spirits and the real ghost is you. Also, what's going on with Wet Dry World? In some ways, it's a straightforward climb to the top and collect a star kind of level, but with this mechanic for raising and lowering the water, which also corresponds to the height at which you jump into the level's painting. The theme also makes no sense. It's a water level, sort of, but with these evil wind-up forklift things called heave-hoes and floating aquatic spiders. Is this a sunken civilization along the lines of Atlantis that got taken over by sentient warehouse equipment? Judging by the background image, are we near those boxy hotel pods from the Montreal Olympic Village, but after some apocalyptic flood destroyed everything? Either way, it's creepy. And in a game where the skyboxes consist mostly of vague textures like clouds or more clouds, this is a photo of a real city on planet Earth. The background is a stock photo of Shabam, Yemen, but edited to look underwater in what is arguably Nintendo's goofiest texture. And even learning about this photo's real-world origins doesn't answer any questions at all. I'm honestly more confused than I was before folks online tracked down the source. I try to spend as little time in Wet Dry World as physically possible because this place gives me the willies. But not every level has some deeply unsettling lore. And in that sense, Lethal Lava Land feels the most video gamey. There's no real setup, everything's on fire, most of the surfaces kill you, and it's a level so small you can basically see the whole place right from the start. But this level has really grown on me over the years. It's also a world where the red coins are hilariously easy to collect, and honestly, by this point in the game, it's kind of refreshing to get such an easy star. Perhaps the most maligned level from this entire game would be Rainbow Ride, a largely on-rails level in the spirit of scrolling stages from the NES games. Rainbow Ride is excruciatingly difficult, filled with potential dead ends, and working through the level has more to do with memorizing upcoming obstacles than it does with platforming skill. But with this and TikTok Clock being the only two levels before the game's final star door, I've always viewed them as bonus levels. They aren't strictly necessary to reach the game's final boss, given how many other stars are still available from the rest of the castle. So if you're going to play them at all, then yeah, of course they're going to be difficult to the point of frustration. They're the last two worlds in the game. You're not contractually obligated to play them, unless you're one of those completionist people. And if you go into any game with the goal of collecting all 100% of anything, then you're gonna have to accept a certain amount of throw your controller frustration with that premise. Then there's the graphics. Mario 64 does not look as good as it used to. I first played this game on what was probably a 10-inch portable TV meant for kitchens or camping or something, and I don't know where we found this thing, but it didn't have RCA inputs or working speakers, so I had to use some off-brand N64 RF switch and enjoy the game in complete silence. This, along with the inherent fuzziness of a CRT beam, meant that I was fundamentally looking at different images than we're seeing today. When I finally replayed the game on the 3D All-Stars collection for the Switch, I thought there was some bizarre emulation glitch when Mario's low-poly LOD model made an appearance, and at a surprisingly short distance from the camera, no less. Apparently, he's been there the whole time, but I swear this was not visible on my old setup. And this is what happens when you render games at higher resolutions than expected. The invisible seams become much more apparent. But other than Mario popping in and out of Sega Saturn mode, this game uses a number of very effective tricks to maintain the illusion. I have to point out the brilliant choice to use sprites instead of polygonal models for anything remotely spherical. The performance of a 3D game is reliant on three-sided geometry, and how many of those shapes are actively on screen. So, you want to build the most effective world, both artistically and technically, using as few triangles as possible. And curved surfaces are tricky for this exact reason. Even today, the default sphere in Unreal Editor 4 contains just under 1,000 tries, and the sphere brush uses significantly less. So if things like bob-ombs or falling boulders, of which there are usually multiple being rendered on screen at a given time, were actual 3D models, that would cause a huge performance hit. The one exception is the chain chomp, which has to be able to open its mouth in 3D space, so that's a polygonal model. But everything else is just pictures of circles. With Mario 64 having been developed at the same time as N64 hardware, this was a game built around the limitations of low poly counts and draw distances, and it all blends together seamlessly. In 1997, this was some miracle of real-time, consumer-affordable graphics. And on that note, the audio of Mario 64 is, if I may bust out some film school words, sonically pleasing. Dare I say, an aural experience for your sound holes. Little things we take for granted now, like the waterfall sound slowly fading up as you approach, rather than each environment having a static ambient track, were a novel concept. And the music, Dire Docks in particular, but of course the entire soundtrack, is still one of the great soundtracks in all of gaming, arguably more widely appreciated with each passing year. And if we're gonna geek out about audio for a second, I have to mention the shepherd tone allusion in The Infinite Staircase. Obviously, the most immediate technical marvel is the way the stairs appear to literally go on forever, but the music plays an important part in the effect. The shepherd tone is a famous audio trick that involves two or more sets of tones moving upward or downward depending on the usage. In the case of Mario 64, the bass tone slowly increases in octaves and by the time it reaches the top, it's replaced by a new bass tone to give the illusion of a song that constantly increases in pitch. It's kind of like the sonic equivalent of a rotating barbershop pole, forever climbing upward. Like all great illusions, it still works even when you understand the trick, and it's creepy as hell. Incredible. Alright, hot take time. In the years since Mario 64 was released, one could argue that AAA game design has become complacent. We no longer expect big, creative, risky decisions to be made by companies that trade on the stock market, or have to sign multi-year leases on huge office buildings in Montreal that cost millions of dollars to break. Instead, we look to experimental games by small teams of independent developers to try new things. And if they work, they get copied by AAA studios. Valve took a high-concept student game and turned it into an instant classic. Gone Home walked, pun intended, so Resident Evil 7 could run. And the director has freely admitted this in a few interviews. Which is to say, bold choices in game design carry the risk of alienating consumers, which could mean low sales, and human labor costs money, so Ubisoft just takes the last game and drops the assassin guy in ancient Egypt so everybody's paychecks continue to clear. But here we have Mario 64, a high-budget release with the fate of a massive company hanging in the balance, especially with all those delays, that somehow took big risks. Many of them pay off, like 360-degree movement and this elaborate hub world. And some of them really, really don't, like the flying carpet level or most of the camera controls. But it's always a big swing. There's always a fearlessness to the decisions. And for that, I love this game. If I have a single real complaint, it's the boss fights. Once you get the hang of swinging Bowser around and hurling him at the explosives, you'll quickly realize that it's the game's only mechanic for all three encounters. A couple years later, Insomniac would codify boss fights for 3D platformers, and it's effectively still the blueprint today. Mario Galaxy would eventually take a slightly more Shadow of the Colossus approach and make boss fights into their own levels. But generally, a circular arena with area of effect attacks, specifically these shockwave things, are what we expect with boss fights. But Mario 64 was tasked with rebuilding the entire platform genre from scratch for the era of 3D games. And all things considered, they mostly got it right. But the three nearly identical Bowser fights are a bit of a low point. I'm not in the habit of giving scores, but just this once, I give Super Mario 64 4.5 heave-hoes out of a possible 5. It's a great game, it's still incredibly fun to play, and if you ever get bored, there's a never-ending supply of new levels and total conversion mods from the fanbase. I haven't played the DS remake since it came out, but I remember loving it, and I'm hoping to explore that in a future video. And that's my review of Mario 64. We obviously didn't cover everything, but given the subject matter, I felt like a more offbeat approach was the way to go. Episodes are going to drop on Fridays for the next few months rather than Wednesdays, just for scheduling reasons on my end. Thanks for watching, and as always, I'm Nathan, telling you to keep your files safe, keep your passwords managed, and for goodness sake, don't click on any strange links. We'll see you in a week.